G'day, this is Tommy Wren of Seriously Risky Business, and today the Gruck and I are going to talk about the different cultures in cyber. And by that I mean cyber organizations, so places like NSA, GRU, but also in private industry and traditional hacker culture, and how they change what people do and change the way that organizations operate. I was listening to a podcast about the Venona decrypts, which I've mentioned before, and I won't go into here, but one thing that struck me is that the historian talked about the NSA culture of compliance and legality. And I wondered where that came from. So NSA kind of grew out of a very operational time. A lot of these organizations in the Five Eyes started after World War II. And World War II, of course, it's about getting stuff done because lives are literally at stake and you're not necessarily worried about protecting the privacy of citizens and certainly not non-citizens. So I thought that was interesting that that had come up. What are your views on NSA culture?
Yeah, that's interesting. It reminded me of an anecdote from the deception units during World War II. So the British, they had found this lieutenant who was the guy they wanted. He was smart. He had like the right sort of tricky mind. He was a go-getter. He was a little bit quirky, which was just perfect for them. But the position that they had available was like they needed a major. Like you had to be at a major rank to have this level of responsibility. So they notionally promoted him without a pay raise to major for the duration of that thing. And when the Americans found out about it, like they were sort of flabbergasted. They were like, when we need a major, we get a major. You know, like you say, we have a role open for a major. You know, who needs to be transferred at this time as part of their career thing? Whoever that is, that's now the job that they do. Like that's how it works. What are you guys doing? This is insane. And I think that's a cultural thing as well, is that the, you know, particularly with the, as you mentioned, with the compliance thing, we had Kieran Martin on Glasshouse the other day, and he was talking about how in the UK, there's a lot more like gets done with just a sheet of paper that gets given to a principal who signs off on it, and that's it, you do it. You know, there's no lots of reviews of like authorities and then going to the lawyers and the lawyers go over it and then it comes back. Then it goes through a round of meetings and eventually it gets to a level where it can get sign off, you know, and it's just, there's lots of meetings and lots of people involved. And like, that's not the way the UK does it. They're a lot more.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It feels a bit fly by the seat of your pants, but on the other hand, it feels a bit more like operational.
Yeah. I think my impression is British law has, and maybe jurisprudence has more of an emphasis on proportionality. And so if you can justify something because of these reasons, you're good to go. Not that long ago, I think, well, when I say not that long ago, 20 years ago.
When I was a wee nipper.
Yeah, exactly. Well, ASD did not have a legal framework until, I think, 2001. And so basically everything it did was just because the minister said it's okay to go and do this. So that's a similar kind of a concept to what you're describing in GCHQ. It's okay because someone authorizes it. And like there was process around that. But I think having a legal framework is probably actually better.
Yeah. Well, like my understanding is that, I mean, the UK is not operating outside of a legal framework, you know, like when you...
No.
Right. It, just to be clear on that.
It's just that much more, this person's authorized to delegate this authority.
Right.
You know, they can make a call.
Yeah. Like you put forward, we're doing this thing for this reason because we expect this to happen. Here are some of the risks. Are you okay with it? And someone says yes, and that's it. You're done. Rather than having committees review it. So that's, you know, like that's a culture. And I think the GCHQ has a reputation for sort of being smaller than NSA, not having all of the same like flash tools and that, but still being very good at getting things done. Like this, a little bit more of this plucky, they will, you know, by hook and by crook, they will make sure that it happens. And Metasploit or something like that. I'm pretty sure that they've got good people, but I think that those people haven't been around long enough to get promoted to, you know, the colonels and the lieutenant colonels and like the people who start being able to give actual orders and things like that, where their strategic vision is being realized. I think it's to a degree, it's an age thing. Like, we just haven't had people around long enough to reach, to get promoted to those levels. They just don't have the seniority yet.
Yeah, so there's been a couple of stories I'm aware of recently that seem kind of relevant. One of them was that I think just a couple of weeks ago that someone was reporting that people were concerned about the rotation culture in the military. So there's often in militaries, people move every 2, 3, 4 years. And of course, that's terrible for building up a huge amount of corporate knowledge. And I think there's probably many jobs like this, but I think cyber operations are one of those jobs where just having done it for a long time is actually useful. You build up that expertise and if you're following the same target as well over a long period of time, you tend to learn, you know, whatever it is that Joe Bloggs does. And
but the other thing about cyber is it's a skill set that rusts so rapidly that taking time off can like seriously inhibit your ability to keep up.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of, you have to run as fast as you can just to stay in one place. So, I mean, I know that some parts of the military are really, like, they don't like cyber. Like, cyber is weird. It's got strange people. They do, you know, there's fat people who are in basements. This is not military stuff, you know.
That was the other thing, that the fitness standards. I think in Australia they've talked about having different fitness standards for cyber operations people as opposed to people in the regular army, which kind of makes sense again. Part of that is it's just not a requirement that you be fighting fit, like literally fighting fit if you're a cyber operator. And the other part was in terms of appealing to a broader demographic of potential recruits. So we've talked about a bit about Britain, a bit about the US. What about China and North Korea?
I had a friend that I knew over here who had worked at an NGO and he'd been stationed in North Korea for like 1 or 2 years or something. And he had a couple of stories that he told me. One of them was that they were legally required to leave their passport in the office. Like, it had to be in a locked drawer or whatever, but it had to be kept in the place of work. And obviously, one morning he goes in, he opens the drawer, and his passport is gone. And so, because he sort of, like, he knows how things work, he takes a piece of paper and he writes a note, says, like, note to self, remember to return passport. And he puts it in the drawer. And then the next day when he comes in, the note is gone and his passport is back in place. And the other thing was that they're required to hire sort of locals. Like, if you want a secretary or a, you know, some set of jobs have to be hired from local people. You can't bring in your own janitor and stuff like that. So they had hired these two guys for basic office computer tasks. You know, it was like just a little bit of Word, and their resumes were like, you know, proficient to 60% in Microsoft Word, you know, knows how to open Excel. And they had hired these guys because they did, you know, they seemed to be fine. They match all the stuff. He said that they never, like, they had this weird way of speaking, like they wouldn't ever speak loud. It was always very, very quiet, sort of like, so it wouldn't travel far and it would be hard to overhear. But the other thing was, he had a problem with his computer one time and he was struggling with it. And one of the guys came over, looked at it and just like fucking regedit, like blew all the stuff up, fixed everything immediately. And he was like, there you go, sir. Walks off. And he suddenly realized that he'd been given, like, these guys had sort of been passed off as like computer novices when they were actually incredibly competent and being put there sort of, like, he knew that they were there to monitor him, but it turns out that they were really, really good. And, you know, like, there's that, and then there's what we know about how they get sent to places to operate. So there'll be a team that gets sent to a country. They will stay in a hotel. They will operate. They will generate money. They have handlers who stay with them and monitor what they're doing and make sure that they're on a mission. They're not deviating. There's no like crypto going to the wrong wallet. None of that's happening. That's very focused. And despite that sort of really rigid environment, if you look at Lazarus over the last, you know, 10 years, they have gone from sort of a joke in the stuff that they were doing, you know, like, hello, I'm your friend, please click on the not a virus I'm sending you, to multi-month, multi-person phishing things where they recruit someone, they develop and use their own ODAs. They've become very proficient in hacking without adopting any of the trappings of hacking that we have in the West, you know, where it's like the individual going out and learning something and sort of striving against the boundaries of the system and becoming whatever, like a proficient hacker in their own right in that way. It's obviously very regimented and controlled and is also producing highly skilled hackers.
Yeah, some of the most interesting hacks I've written about have been North Korean ones. Some of the cryptocurrency hacks where they've used BGP to hijack parts of a mobile application that was used to interact with wallets. So it's kind of this quite, I wouldn't say convoluted, but a chain of several steps that resulted in the end result. So that people who are using the wallet in this mobile app were actually sending it somewhere else entirely. And that was like just a very nice piece of work.
Yeah, so I mean, they've managed to get very good, and you know, on the one hand, it's sort of like, well, if you do something for 15 years and you don't get good at it, maybe this is not the right calling for you. But on the other hand, they have gotten good. They've managed to retain that sort of institutional knowledge and to improve over time without significant, like they're not sending people to trainings, you know, like they're not going out and doing this. They don't really have that sort of access.
Yeah. It seems like that's the example where it's most both tightly controlled, but also with a great deal of operational freedom. You know, the schemes they come up with are, I won't say harebrained, but it doesn't seem like there's a central authority saying, go after this or go after that. There's a central authority saying, you will work on these problems and raise money for the state. Off you go.
Yeah, you know, that's very much actually, when you look at like, what is the best culture for generating creative subordinates who are good at doing their job, that's sort of the thing that you want. It's the giving them goals, but you know, we want you to achieve this thing, like use the skills that you have to do that.
Yeah.
You're very much giving them the freedom to operate as long as, you know, they're helping you achieve the strategic objectives that you have set.
So there we go. We've decided that the North Korean hacking operation is the best one to work in. You've
there you go.
Autonomy and purpose.
Yeah, you've got mission. You've got complete operational autonomy. You're allowed freedom to go after almost anyone. It's very, very mission oriented, but it's a vague mission. It's generating money. So anyone looking to change careers, you know, if you're mid career and you want to sort of shift into maybe a little bit more hands-on keyboard, North Korea, place for you.
So what about China then?
China, I think, is a weird one. So I don't know a lot about inside the PLA. I know a little bit more about the external contractor / defense contractor / criminal thing. And the Chinese have their own sort of hacker culture, and it's similar but not the same to Western hacker culture. Like they do have all of those, you know, who's the best sort of meritocracy in theory based, like being super good.
I wrote a piece that looked at the history of Chinese hacker culture, and in the early days it seemed very, very much like Western hacker culture, the same sort of ethos. What appears is that the Chinese state has deliberately encouraged nationalistic fervor. And so it seemed that there's some in the hacker community in China who actively bought into that and 15 years ago actively wanted to hack for the state because, you know, this is a good thing. And then there's others, of course, who don't buy into that state bull because You know, the state just wants to manipulate you. But there's also a different, which we touched on, I think, before, a different relationship between the state and, air quotes, private industry, in that the Chinese conception under the Communist Party is that we're all working for the benefit of the party. And I guess the tent, the sort of SIGINT tent or the cyber tent, encompasses many more people than it does in the West. And so they feel a lot more comfortable about just outsourcing stuff because we're all on the same team. Hey.
Yeah. They also, I think, like if you look at the way that they do the IP theft, you know, they've got these fusion centers, which are basically these places where like the state and industry sort of come together and they'll have events and whatever. And this is how they wash all of that information that they collect back into the private sector, right? So they will have a meeting between military people and, you know, nanotechnology or AI or, you know, air industry, whatever the sector happens to be. And those guys will say, like, look, these are the top companies. This is sort of, these are the guys that are doing really innovative stuff. And the military will go, like, that's interesting. And, you know, and then 6 months later, when they have the next meeting, it'll be like, so hypothetically, if I was to leave this hard drive here, I hope I would find it when I come back in 4 hours, you know, or however it's actually done. But to me, what I find fascinating is if you look at the process, right? You use an espionage agency to do an espionage operation to steal information, bring it back, potentially have it translated. But you know that's classified stuff, right? Like the process of stealing information means that when you have it, that's classified, and then giving that over to private sector to use. Like that's not a thing that, for example, the West could do. Right. Like if you were to go to the ASD and say, like, hey, what we need you to do is break into some German wind farms and steal their tech for our wind farms. Like ASD has the technical capability to do that, but there would not be the bureaucratic processes in place to facilitate that. The idea of stealing something, declassifying it, and just giving it away, like that's not a thing that they do.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I don't think it's even the bureaucratic processes, right? It's just not what the purpose of those organizations
right.
is.
It's more that's... like the system could not do it if it wanted to. Like it just, it's not, that's not what the system is set up to do. So, you know, it should never do that, etc. But if it was tasked with doing that, it would be incapable of doing it. It's just, it's not a thing that, like it could, maybe bodge something together if it had to, but it wouldn't be like everyone would be very uncomfortable the entire way through. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. But it seems like a good point to talk about just hacker culture in general. And so I kind of touched on it with the Chinese state, where I thought that it felt to me that Chinese hackers, at least back in the day, had very much what I'd recognize as a hacker culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's this idea proposed by Dave Itell, and I subscribed to it for a while. Now I'm a lot less sure. So his theory was that hacker culture is sort of innate in the process of hacking, or it's so tightly linked to it that if you learn how to hack, you sort of adopt part of the ethos of this hacker culture, you know, this a bit more individualism, lack of respect for authority, the I can do it myself, you know, wearing all black, you know, liking cyberpunk, liking sci-fi, various different things, like where we don't tend to have a lot of very religious people. The set of beliefs that we have are fairly liberal and progressive overall. And His thing was like, look, if you're a state and you start standing up one of these organizations and sort of recruiting and putting in all of these hackers and training them up, does it become a problem? And you go, you know, you get all of these people who now have a different way of looking at the world. They have a skill set that makes them quite powerful, even individually. And it's not necessarily the same way of looking at the world that goes very well with authoritarian regimes, with tight bureaucracies, with particular ways that you have to live in more lockdown societies. And
you're saying his argument is that the process of hacking results in the personality rather than the personality leading someone down that path. To me, there's quite a lot of hacking is about wanting to understand how things work and why they don't work.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a trait that could possibly go with questioning authority, because you just question right. everything.
Right, but you know, here's the counter example that we've just talked about is the North Koreans. I don't think you all become a good hacker in North Korea and then go back and be like, you know what, I'm out of here. I refuse to follow these rules. This is insane. Like, I don't think that is a career path that rewards that sort of thinking, and that people who would think that way would succeed. I think I'm not sure that they're as tightly coupled as the free experiments that we get in the West make them appear. I think an interesting counterexample even to that is in Iran, where, as you know, like the Iranian thing is very much these smaller units, like these little companies that do their own thing. And what I've been led to understand is that there is very much a hacker ethos culture amongst the people that operate there. Like the guys who are doing the actual hacking think that their managers and their bosses are idiots and that they can pull a fast one on them. So we know that there's always this thing about, like, the Iranians, they'll use their tooling from 9 to 5 to do state work, and then
while they're on the clock.
Right. And then they will use the same tooling to generate money for themselves afterwards. That, to a degree, is because they think that they can get away with it because their bosses don't know and won't be able to figure it out. And they have this culture where the people who work inside the company do not necessarily have the same up and down loyalty as they do sort of lateral. Between companies, they all have a community of hackers who sort of vie for prestige with each other, but they don't recognize the authority of their bosses and the companies that they work in as structures or hierarchies that they care about. It's all between themselves, much more to an extent, which is, again, to a degree, it's similar to the West, where, like, there's the idea of the InfoSec community, and we work at different companies, you know, like that, and that's where you work is not like who you are in any sense.
Yeah, yeah. And people sit in Slack channels where they share information across companies.
Yeah, yeah. So that ethos does exist in states where we would think it might not, where they're more authoritarian stuff. So I think it is partially true, at least. Like, when it's given the freedom to grow, that does happen.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can buy that. I'm not sure that the process of hacking leads to that sort of personality. I question the causality, at least.
To be fair, I'm not. I can't claim to be representing his idea 100% authentically.
Right. Yep. So we weren't verbal, Dave. We'll.
Yeah. So, I mean, that theory, you know, the theory that hacking sort of generates this ethos where you don't trust authority, where you sort of don't believe in formal religions, where you're sort of more progressive. The idea that it comes from the process of hacking, which rewards that sort of thinking. Like, you're not going to be a good hacker if you read the documentation and say, oh, okay, well, that's the way it is then.
I put a number between 0 and 100 here, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've tried all the things I'm supposed to be able to do. Yeah. Yep. And
that's it. Job done.
Good. Works for me. Yeah. But I think you're right. I think it's not a causal relationship. It's definitely, if you're the sort of person who reads the documentation and says, okay, like, that's a good starting point. Like, but does it accept blue as a number?
Yeah, so interestingly, or maybe not, I used to work in a section that was extremely analytical, and it was full of scientists. I'm a biologist, there was a chemist, a physicist, a mathematician, an astronomer or astrophysicist, and someone who'd been there longer than I had said that we used to get engineers as well, but they never worked out. And it's the totally different mindset in that an engineer gets a set of requirements and builds a system that meets those requirements, whereas a scientist starts out with a problem where I don't know what's going on here and I've got to try and figure it out.
As we talk about this sort of like hacker culture of this sort of like individualism, distrust of authority, I think it's interesting to look at Germany, where they've got a huge number of hackers, you know, like they've just got a very, very large community, but they are very, very anti-government, anti-authoritarian. They don't want to work for the state. The idea of doing anything in cooperation with authority is just, they would rather die than ever work for the police.
Yeah.
And so what I'm sort of thinking about is how Germany does not have a good cyber program. Like you don't, they don't have great cyber intelligence agencies. They don't have their own cybercom that's any good. They don't have any of these state cyber things. And to a degree, I wonder like how much of that is because if they were to try and recruit from their pool of like people who can do this, those are not the people that would ever agree to working for the state. You know, does the culture in this case actually inhibit the state from getting good? And that sort of problem where you now have people who are so independent that you can't control them when you want to, that sort of thinking and that approach, that might be a thing that other countries would experience. Like if you create this sort of hacker community because you want them for your state so that you can use them, and then suddenly you find out that you've got all these hackers and they hate you. It's, in a way, it's German culture, is that there's, you could say, like, it's another sort of culture that's coming in, that there's a very recent experience with having oppressive state apparatus, which would make people incredibly wary of ever working for the state to sort of facilitate these things. So that could be holdovers from that. So like France, for example, you'd think would be similar, or the Netherlands, maybe. Like the Netherlands is quite similar in that they're, you know, European, modern, rich, all of these things. But the Dutch have very good cyber, and they also have a very good hacker community, and that hacker community also has a similar ethos of like, we don't want to work for the state. We don't have the, like, no one grows up and says, you know, I want to be a state-sponsored hacker. You know, like, that's not a thing. But they do it, and they do work for it. And I think maybe you're right in that they don't have an experience of distrusting the state for legitimate reasons in their recent memory. I don't know.
Yeah, I think one of the things those intelligence agencies have going for them is that you can lawfully do things that are, for a hacker, pretty cool. And I wonder if German reticence comes about from there's this sort of reluctance to demonstrate military might, and maybe that flows through to the what you're allowed to do and therefore the attraction that that mission has for the hacker community. Anyway, that seems like a great place to end. We've surveyed culture across the world and in the international hacker community. So thanks a lot, Grant.
Always good to talk to you.